Okay, so this is the 9/11 Truth Teleconference for the 29th of November, 2017. Ken Freeland, Cheryl Curtis facilitating, Craig McKee, Secretary. And we will proceed with the roll call. Go ahead, Craig.
A couple of things. When people were referring to Mike, who's Mike?
Mike Springman.
Oh, okay, great. Hi, Mike.
Hi. It's good to talk to you. We exchanged emails.
Yes, yes. Yeah, terrific. And I have something on, Cheryl, do you know who, we have A. Green on the list of people who have called in. Is that Mike's phone?
I don't know. Mike is coming through Skype, so I don't know. Is there an A. Green on the phone?
Yeah, there's an A. Green and an 831 number.
No, but I'm asking, is there someone by that name here?
Oh.
Is someone right. calling in on an 831 number, 831-899?
Yeah.
Anybody want to claim that? If no one claims
it
after, is someone claiming it?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Who is this? Identify yourself, please. Yeah, we can hear you, but what's your name?
Name is Doug McKenzie.
Huh?
I couldn't catch that.
Me neither.
Doug McKenzie.
Oh, Cody. Hello.
Doug McKenzie.
Hello.
Oh, Doug McKenzie. Okay. Sorry. Got it.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so what I have so far is Ken Freeland, Craig McKee, Cheryl Curtis, Andrew Craig, Frank Tolopko, Mike Springman, Paul Zaremka, Lynn Bradbury, Doug McKenzie, Charles Ewing Smith, Kelly David, Carl Golliman, Dan Hennen, John O'Malley, Tim Michael, Adam Syed, and Peter Michael Ketchum. Did I miss anybody?
Yeah, this is Wayne.
Oh, Wayne. Okay. Got you. So that's it. That should be it, Ken.
Okay. So with that done, we'll now turn to the question of approving the minutes from the last meeting. I take it, Craig, that we want to use the revised minutes that were sent out more recently?
Yeah, the only difference is I accidentally duplicated one of the headings. So I had the 9/11 rogue thing, the identical heading for two out of the three agenda items by
mistake.
All right,
so there's no substantial difference between the two versions. And so.
No, there's no other difference. Yeah.
Do we want to approve the minutes then as circulated by Craig? Any objections to approving the minutes? Hearing none, then the minutes are approved, and we'll move on to tonight's draft agenda. There are two major items on tonight's agenda. Anybody want to amend or critique it in any way before we proceed? Well, hearing none, then I guess we'll just go right ahead with it, and we're ready for our first item then. Craig was the first one to jump in last month requesting an item, and that would be his presentation of a project that he's involved with regarding what happened at the Pentagon or what didn't happen at the Pentagon. So as Craig needs no introduction to anyone on the call, I'll just let him go right ahead with it. Go ahead, Craig.
Okay, thank you, Ken. My presentation tonight is about the role that the Pentagon evidence has played in the fight for truth and how we might find a more positive direction for the future. I'll address how this topic has artificially divided our movement, and I'll tell you about an initiative that I and some others have taken to help overcome some of these divisions. The unnecessary controversy over the Pentagon starts with a group of researchers who focus all their Pentagon research efforts on supporting one aspect of the official story after another. They use political spin in an effort to turn the entire truth movement around to their way of thinking and to convince everyone that their view is generally gaining acceptance. They represent a very small minority within the movement, but their recognizable names seem to give them influence in excess of the value of their arguments. Within the vast majority who do not believe a large plane hit the building that day, we have those who support a variety of theories. Some think a missile hit. Some think it was an A3 Sky Warrior or a Global Hawk or a military jet, and others believe a plane flew over the building while explosives were detonated inside. And because there are so many theories, it becomes difficult to find common ground, and to say no to the official claim of a 757 crash. Now, let me ask a couple of hypothetical questions. What would we think of a group of truth activists known for other areas of 9/11 research, spent years writing papers, making videos, giving talks, and doing interviews, telling us all the ways that NIST's analysis of the World Trade Center destruction was correct? What if they told us they did this to keep the movement from losing credibility, to keep us from looking like crazy conspiracy theorists with wild ideas about government agents planting explosives in the towers? What if they made it clear they don't believe the whole NIST report, they don't believe Al-Qaeda was behind 9/11, so they can't be accused of supporting the official story? But virtually all the information they presented on the WTC destruction concerned what they thought NIST had gotten right. They almost never talked about what NIST got wrong. What would you think of such a group? For how many years would you politely accept their support for one aspect of the official narrative after another? How concerned would you be when they made statements that seemed indistinguishable from those made by Popular Mechanics or any number of other 9/11 debunkers? Imagine this group writing papers like The Role of Thermal Expansion in the Collapse of Building 7, or Did Jet Fuel Reach the WTC Lobby Through Elevator Shafts? You might expect some serious pushback from those. What if truthers who were prepared to speak against this and who supported architects and engineers for 9/11 truth and their controlled demolition position were relentlessly attacked online? And what if these attacks were accompanied by an equally relentless but more private pressure campaign to push prominent truth activists into dropping their support for the nanothermite hypothesis? How long would you treat this approach as simply a difference of opinion? How would you feel about a significant number of truthers deciding they will no longer get into the fray because the World Trade Center has become too contentious, too divisive? And how would you feel if you stood up to this group and argued passionately for the controlled demolition position, and you were accused of being the cause of division? Now, I don't know if this is the perfect analogy, but I don't think it's far off what we have seen with the Pentagon for the past dozen years or more. Yes, it's true that the evidence there was under tighter government control than at Ground Zero, but not that much tighter. We have a lot of Pentagon evidence that contradicts the official claims. We don't have nanothermite, but we have an alleged plane crash without a plane and a hole not large enough to accommodate one without leaving large pieces of that plane outside. We have anomalous damage, provably doctored video, and very strong evidence for planted explosives. And we have very credible witnesses interviewed thoroughly on camera who contradict the official flight path and therefore the cause of damage. There's somebody making a lot of noise in the background. Any way they could mute their phone, their line?
We'll put you on lecture mode here.
Okay.
So give me just a second here.
Okay, so you can still hear me, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me be clear that I do not claim to know the motives of those participating in this effort or simply excusing it, but I do assert that this campaign to attack some of the strongest evidence the movement possesses had its origins in deception. But beyond the claims of this group, there is a troubling use of spin that many in the movement either don't seem to be aware of or don't seem to be able to see through. Many of us, I believe, wish to think the best of people. We want to believe others are well-intentioned, and I share this view, and this is how I try to live my own life. But I also have journalistic instincts that have served me well over the years. And I have a strong sense of when I'm being manipulated and when something I'm being fed doesn't ring true. I picked up on this almost the first week I became active in the truth movement. The attacks on CIT and those who doubt a Pentagon plane impact were too vitriolic and too systematic to be genuine and spontaneous. And in years since, I've come to recognize the existence of an organized and coordinated spin campaign that is disguised as an organic coming together of experts. Now, this group that I'm talking about, which features familiar names like David Chandler, Jonathan Cole, Ken Jenkins, John Wyndham, Jim Hoffman, Victoria Ashley, the late Frank Legg, and apparently our own Wayne Costi, doesn't write papers telling us how the Pentagon story isn't true. They don't focus their attention on the government claims that are weak or contradicted by evidence. They instead criticize challenges to the official story. When the government gives us evidence that undermines its own narrative, this group rushes to fix the evidence so that it aligns, or appears to align, with the official impact scenario. And they claim to be using science to keep us from embarrassing ourselves, even though science does not prove any of their claims. The result is division and understandable anger from the members of the majority who are paying attention. When the NTSB released an animation created from the alleged flight data recorder data, the official story had a new problem. The animation shows the flight path as pretty much exactly what the north of Sitgo witnesses described, which does not match the damage. It also had the plane too high to hit the building. Now, what did our Pentagon research do with that? They set out to make the evidence support the official story after all. Warren Studd, who has no aviation background, aided by Legg, claims to have decoded a missing portion of the data. So now the path perfectly matches the official one, and yet no aviation professional that I'm aware of will endorse what they have done. Pilots for 9/11 Truth has rejected Stutt's claims utterly. In Massimo Mizuko's film, September 11, The New Pearl Harbor, we see synchronized video from two almost identical camera angles, as confirmed by the identical shape of the smoke cloud in both. Just one frame out of roughly 100 in common between the two views does not match, however, the one that allegedly shows a plane. This is evidence that one or both views were doctored, another blow to the official story. But Chandler and Jenkins shift into gear to rescue the claim that an airliner crossed the lawn. They claim the two views are not precisely synchronized after all, and that this accounts for the substantial difference we see. When I told Mizuko about this, he reacted angrily and reiterated that his research confirms conclusively that the camera views were indeed synchronized. Now, this is more serious than just a dispute over evidence. This issue is the one that has been used to artificially divide this movement. The one area of evidence that can best tie the 9/11 deception directly to the government is the one being marginalized. Truthers are being convinced the subject is too controversial and that they must stay away or risk being called divisive. Jenkins continues to tell us how some in the movement don't believe an impact took place because they suffer from confirmation bias and that they have beliefs and engage in speculation, while he and his colleagues instead use the scientific method. The spin continues with articles like Wyndham's bringing closure to the 9/11 Pentagon debate and presentations like Chandler's ironically named Going Beyond Speculation. The damage to the movement has been considerable. So, what to do about it? The idea occurred to me recently that there might be a way for those who do not believe in the official crash scenario, again, the vast majority of the movement, to put aside their individual theories and find common ground with a statement that they could all agree on. So I decided to compile a list of those who are either already on record publicly as stating that no 757 hit the building or are willing to go on record. In the first 13 days, we have 420 names from all over the world. I was delighted to hear on Monday that David Ray Griffin has given his support to the inclusion of his name, and he told me that he sees no conflict between what I'm doing and his consensus approach. Our Facebook group discussions have been, for the most part, respectful and productive because we're focused on the statement that we all have in common rather than fighting over details. The only notes of discord have come from a couple of visitors to the page who have decided that this attempt to find common ground is itself divisive, apparently because it doesn't include the small minority previously discussed. But to reach back to our hypothetical from earlier, imagine someone telling you that it is divisive to believe nanothermite was used because supporters of directed energy weapons might feel left out. By coming together over the statement that no 757 hit the Pentagon, we stand firmly against the government's claim, while at the same time we minimize division over what actually happened. This is important because there is only one entity that could be responsible for a faked plane crash at the Pentagon, and that's the U.S. government itself. I hope you find this effort to be worthwhile and that you will give it your support. The Pentagon is the biggest obstacle to the movement progressing in a cooperative and positive way, and we simply can't settle for the status quo any longer. We need to find ways to come together without watering our message down. I don't claim that this answers all our problems, but I believe it's a positive step. At the very least, it is an honest effort to help. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you for that presentation, Craig, and we will now go into... If you... If you'd like to ask a question, just press star 6, and you will be put automatically into the queue if you confirm that you want to ask a question or make a comment, and we'll go from there. And I would like to be listed last myself to make a comment. So let us proceed. Wayne is first. Go ahead, Wayne.
Yes, Craig. Yes, Craig, thanks. You know, first of all, appreciate the effort that you're putting forward to try to figure out the things that we have in common. I think that's good. But, you know, you've made so many misrepresentations in what you just said. Let me just run through just a few of them. You can respond if you want. First of all, you said the hole's not big enough. It's 90 feet of continuous opening on the first floor. The loose change in plain sight and others talk about the 16-foot hole. No one would know that it's larger than that, and that's a typical answer you get from people when they say, how big's the hole? 16 feet. Credible witnesses that made statements that for CIT that you're talking about neglect the 2001, for example, the Center for Military Intelligence History and the Library of Congress interviews of, for example, Chadwick Brooks, who says he saw the light poles being knocked down like matchsticks. And George Amon, who not only described the impact into the building, but the sounds of it, and it hit, having hit the light poles as the tops were flying up. I mean, these are things that are quite obvious. Your comment about the NTSB animation being in the right place puts CIT witnesses, Edward Pake and Terry Morin, in trouble because they're absolutely credible witnesses, as you said, because they're claiming it's on the other side of the Sheridan and low. The provably doctored video, if you take a look, you'll see in both videos from both camera locations something flying up out towards the camera to the out from the wall to the right, and it creates an arc. And if you trace the arc, they are very different because of the different locations. So, and the smoke is not identical in those two frames. So there's so many things wrong with what you've just said. I hope that you and your group will talk about some of these issues and how you can't rely on things like the doctored video that Mazzucco put together or his hypothesis. So anyway, those are just a couple of things. I hope that when you have your discussions, you address the full range of issues. With that, I'll turn the mic over. Thanks for the opportunity to comment.
Okay. You want to respond to that, Craig?
Yeah, yes, I do. Wayne, you keep bringing up this 16-foot hole. No one is talking about a 16-foot hole anymore. That was what people thought 15 years ago or 13 years ago. And once it became clear that that was not correct, I mean, David Ray Griffin, I think, mentioned the 16-foot hole in the new Pearl Harbor. And then when he got to the new Pearl Harbor revisited, he made that correction because it became evident to everyone that there was a much larger hole on the ground floor and the 16-foot hole was on the second floor. Now, nobody's talking about this, except now you're bringing it back and you're implying that I am somehow claiming that the hole is 16 feet or that other people who are in my camp, if you will, are claiming this. This is baloney, and I don't know why you're trying to spin it this way. Okay, the hole you call a hole 90 feet continuous because the columns that are still there may be disconnected at the bottom. So to you that constitutes a 90 foot continuous hole, but it's not a 90 foot continuous hole. As I think Barbara Honegger and I would both agree, the continuous opening is more like 50 feet. But the damage, the holes in the wall do go to about 90 feet. But the plane has a wingspan of 125 feet. And because it's coming in on an angle, that would project out to 160 feet. So the hole is, in fact, not large enough for the plane. So that's one thing. Now, we're back to the witnesses again, and you're talking about things that Brooks and Amon said. Brooks and Amon are North Path witnesses. They clearly put the plane on the north path, which means it cannot have hit the light poles. It can't physically. I mean, Amon couldn't be more clear as an Earth Path witness. Okay? Now, what else did you mention? Well, the NTSB. I don't know. To me, that, you know, we're talking about evidence that the plane was on a different flight path. That's the point of that. So I'm not even really sure what your point was about Paik and Morin. And as for the videos, you're saying that there's an arc that's different or something coming out from the wall that's different in the two frames? Well, or I don't know what you mean by two frames, but this is exactly the point. The whole thing matches up except where the plane is. So that can't be. The plane should be, when you look at the video that's taken from the concrete barrier, you should see the plane, but you don't. So, you know, I think you're quite wrong when you say that there were so many things wrong in what I said. I don't think there was anything wrong in what I said. So that's all I've got on that.
Okay, again, *6 if you wish to make a comment or ask a question. While we're waiting to see if anybody else wants to say anything, I'll ask Craig. Oh, I'm sorry. Here's Paul. Paul Zaremko would like to make a comment or ask a question. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Craig, first of all, I applaud the idea of what you're doing. I mean, and I think Wayne doesn't understand, because when Wayne says that your group should be discussing anything, well, you're not going to be discussing it with the 420 people. These are 420 people who have thought about this a lot and have reached different, disparate conclusions, but all consistent with a plane not hitting, that plane hitting the Pentagon. That's clear, Wayne, so I think you should recognize that you cannot expect 420 people to rethink because of what you are claiming. Anyway, Craig, I do have one comment, or I'd like your reaction. I mean, this is about David Ray Griffin saying that there's no disparity between the consensus panel and this issue about his opinion about the plane hitting the Pentagon. I don't think that's 100% correct. I mean, I was on a consensus panel. I was fired from it for reasons that I don't even want to go back to. Two other people left the consensus panel precisely because the Pentagon issue wasn't being addressed. And in the final analysis, I mean, he is the one who decides who's on that panel. So he has, I mean, I'm not trying to be too hard on him, but I don't think it's just a white sheet here either. He has set up a panel which doesn't reach a consensus to even discuss the Pentagon in a serious way. At least that's my perspective. So anyway, I'd welcome your reaction to that. That's all.
Okay. Thank you. Make it quick, please, Craig, because there are a couple other people that want to make comments, and I do too, and we are out of time on this, okay?
Okay. Paul, I agree with you, and I have serious concerns about the fact that the consensus panel has kind of almost given up on the Pentagon, not given up on it, but they really have not dealt with the Pentagon evidence at all, unfortunately, and I'm not a fan of the consensus approach, because it does water the evidence down. It does say, well, let's leave out the contentious stuff about the plane impact and just focus on Hani Honjer's skills and Barbara Olson's calls and that sort of thing. So I agree with you that I have reservations about that.
All right, Dan, please make your comment quick, and your response quick.
This is Dan Hennon. I would just like to make a comment. I'd like to applaud Craig McKee for setting up this page. It's a great resource on Facebook to be able to go there and talk with like-minded individuals. Obviously, no 57 did hit the Pentagon, but I'd like to put a request into this group that the topic no longer gets brought up. I do believe it's a waste of time. Thank you.
Well, if you want to do that, you'll have to put it on the agenda as a proposal, okay? That would need to be noticed, okay? Okay, thank you. All right, and Frank Talopko, make it quick, please, Frank. Thank you.
Yes, very quickly. How do we move forward from this? You've gotten people that have signed on to the general consensus idea. How do we move forward?
Well, I mean, you know, I guess I'm starting with this. So, I mean, you know, I really feel like we're at a standstill because of this the supposed controversy that we're dealing with. So I'm trying to take a first step by just getting the majority to focus on the most important thing. And once that happens, I mean, I'll give you just a quick example. You know, I used to kind of very commonly, if I saw somebody on Facebook who said something like, oh, it was definitely a cruise missile or something, I would tend to want to argue with them, or I'd say, like, well, there's no evidence for that. Like, I'd feel like we need to, you know, focus together. But now, in this particular Facebook group that we've created to go with this list, I don't feel the need to do that because we're focusing on the central statement. So I don't know where we go after that. I just kind of feel like I want to get us over this major obstacle. And I think that'll be a really, really good start. And then I guess we'll see where we go from there.
Okay, thanks. And well, you sort of answered my question that I have, Craig, with your last statement, but I just want to clarify here. I heard through the grapevine that David Chandler did try to post on your Facebook page, but he wasn't permitted to. Is there a truth to that?
Yes. He's asked to join the group, and I haven't sort of made a decision what to do about that yet because, you know, I've heard that he has sort of got a habit of, you know, in some cases on Facebook, sort of dropping in and making comments and then not responding to questions after that. And I think it's fine if he wants to actually stay and debate it, then that would be interesting. But I mean, this is a group for people who don't believe a plane hit the Pentagon.
Have you communicated that to him?
No, I have not.
Thank you.
I mean, I've been thinking about what would be best for the group. Is it good to bring people in that are going to just argue the other side? No.
Well, it would certainly help clarify where they really stand as opposed to where others think they stand, but that's just my opinion. So anyway, said that, thank you for your response, and we need to close this out because we're out of time, okay? And it's time for our next presentation. But thank you, Craig, for a succinct presentation and for your responses and for everybody who participated in the conversation. All right, the next... our special guest tonight is Andrew Craig, and to introduce him and handle this segment, my co-facilitator, Cheryl Curtis. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Yeah, before we get into that, I just want to check. There's someone who joined the call who has a phone number 323-210-9483. Could you identify yourself? Everyone's muted, so can we unmute them, Ken?
Oh, sure, yeah. One moment.
I unmuted him.
Yeah, this is 323-210-9483. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, what's your name?
Gerald, yeah, Gerald Pechenuk. I got in touch with Ken and Craig, got the call.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Yeah.
I don't know if this is appropriate, but we just had a big showing with Bill Binney and Ray McGovern of The Good American, and I was hoping more could be done around Binney's.
So you'll have time at the end of the call to talk about that if you want, Cheryl?
We do announcements at the end, and you can talk about it there if you wish.
Sure, no problem. Yeah, thanks, no problem. I'll go back on mute, or you can mute it on your end, no problem.
Okay, and then there was another person who joined who's coming out. There's two Frank Tolupkos, but one of them, Frank, you're not on two different phone calls, are you? Two different phones?
I don't think so.
So did someone else join the call who would like to announce themselves?
It could be somebody at a 914 number.
Maybe.
No, this is Sheila Casey, but I'm not at 914.
Oh, okay, so that's probably you then that's coming in there. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. So great. So let's move on then with Andrew. Andrew grew up in New York City. He did his undergraduate work at Cornell University in history, and he holds a law degree from University of Chicago and from Yale. He was a longtime reporter at the Hartford Courant, and is the author of the book Spiked about the newspaper business. He also wrote the book recently, I think it was 2013, on presidential puppetry, called Presidential Puppetry. He's the editor and co-founder of the Justice Integrity Project. And he's done extensive research on the JFK assassination and has lots of great info on his website, which is justice-integrity.org. I would encourage people to check it out. It's a great website. He also began researching about 9/11. And not only is he really smart and really accomplished, but we've had the pleasure of having him speak here in Connecticut, and he's also a lot of fun, a great guy. So, and tonight he's going to be sharing with us about the latest in the JFK assassination. So, Andrew, welcome, and thanks for coming on to share with us.
No, thank you for the great
Did we mute Andrew?
Sorry, Andrew.
People
can hear you, but you won't be able to hear them. No, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Cheryl. And I thought it was an impressive presentation before, and I'm not sure what the format is, whether it's questions, which is how I normally work with Cheryl, but I think with your system here, maybe I should take your opening question and just run with it for at least a little bit. One other part of my introduction I'll add is that I've done a lot of controversial writing, particularly in presidential puppetry, talking about CIA and other covert intelligence influences on both our presidents, but their top advisors. And the gist is how much they're controlled and not the independent actors that they're portrayed in the mainstream media. And at a session that Cheryl had during Q&A, someone asked about 9/11, and that was my coming out on that. I felt that I should address it and express the skepticism I have on that. And so since then, that's been a part of my work. And in fact, for at least over a year, I've been on the weekly 9/11 Lawyers for Truth weekly conference calls that Jane Clark and others host, and I spoke at the A9/11 event about 13 months ago in Cooper Union. So with that prologue, Cheryl had asked me to talk about the what really happened on this JFK document release, because the mass media totally misreported it, and it really takes quite a bit of attention to figure out what happened. To briefly recap the background, after the Oliver Stone movie in 1991, there began public pressure that was quite strong for Congress to get into this and appoint a commission to declassify the documents. And that commission got underway in the 1990s, and a procedure to declassify documents was started, and the final release was supposed to be October 26th of this year, of a kind of rolling debate. And for the last couple of years, there had been no major document release, and we in the somewhat naive but ever hopeful citizenry, and particularly those who advocate for transparent government on these sensitive issues, were constantly told, well, everything's going to be released in 2017, and it's going to be big, and people are speculating all about it. Now, I've been involved in a group called Citizens Against Political Assassinations, and I'm on the board, and I've helped organize events in anticipation of this document release. One other thing is I'm the webmaster, and I've used that position to put 9/11 developments on the website under the view that, mass destruction like that is certainly assassination. Here's the core of what happened on the document release. Without explanation, there was a document dump on July 24th, and it was about 3,000 documents, and people were interested and excited and went through them. The big question was, what happens next? And so on October 26th, that's the final big date, nobody could figure out what was going on. And I managed to get onto a phone call with the White House, a conference call, and it was pretty chaotic. It was the nighttime. And there was a release, probably about 6 p.m., of documents, and people didn't quite know what it was. The scholarly community that's grown up around this that I had joined was filled with all kinds of emails. What does it mean? And here's, at long last, what it means, I think, that we were gamed, the public, this research community. It's been described as a release process that was chaotic, a travesty, a fiasco. President Trump's announcement with great fanfare said, we're releasing these documents, but we have security concerns, and so we'll be releasing other documents over the next 6 months. And what was released were kind of unindexed. People couldn't figure out where it fit in the grand scheme of things. Many of the documents, when you think about it, or once you looked at them, or once the experts looked at them, they realized that were previously released documents with some of the redactions removed. But the documents also had, many of them had redactions, including new redactions of material that had been previously released. And as history, there were something like 4 million pages of documents pertaining to the Kennedy assassination that had been released in previous years. Then there were another release or two in November of different documents. And again, you have to be almost a scholar to figure it out. And another thing that happened in this was a tiny few experts, pseudo-experts, actually government stooges, who have basically written books confirming the official story, were the main go-to people by the media. And I monitored this pretty closely through my various interests. My main interests are current affairs, but I look on certain events like the JFK assassination and 9/11 as kind of a Rosetta Stone to understand current secrets. And what we have here is what looks like a chaotic process, but the hand-picked experts used by the mainstream media kind of use whatever happens to say, well, the official story looks right because there's no smoking gun. And let me put a name on a couple of these experts because it illustrates common problems with 9/11, I think. Specifically, one of them, Philip Sheenan, wrote a book called The Commission about 9/11. He's a former New York Times reporter. And often his sidekick is Larry Sabato, who's a political science professor at the University of Virginia, also a home, of course, to Philip Zelikow in a different department. But what you have there is the concept of a major state university that most people are going to think, well, these are tenured professors, they must be honest brokers who know what they're talking about. And then, of course, in Sheenan, you have a former New York Times reporter who's written books that, in a sense, confirm the official story. So they're all over the place commenting on these JFK documents. And we, the independent researchers, are left struggling to get our messages out. And yet, all of this is almost cleverly intended to throw a few little bones to researchers who spot shiny objects here and get a little, maybe, local renown by a discovery that is maybe good for the individual researcher, and they get their moment, but doesn't really affect the larger understanding of the problem, or the crime, I guess. And here's my own personal overview. You know, there's going to be a lot of different views of this, but I just got back from speaking at two major annual conventions of JFK researchers in Dallas on the surrounding the dates of the assassination in November 17th to 19th, the weekend. Of course, the assassination was November 22nd, 1963. And here is my kind of overview, and I focus on the cover-up and the media because that's what continues to be important. Who pulled the trigger is of lesser importance. Even who ordered it, so to speak, is almost unknowable. We know it's, in a sense, the military-industrial complex. But, you know, the search for the smoking gun is doomed to failure. I mean, when you have a political assassination that is almost overwhelmingly likely to have been created by the CIA, these things are not written up in memo form like a purchase order at a chemical company for sulfate. You know, where you say, we want to buy sulfate from such and such a country. These are compartmentalized decisions, word of mouth, and if there is anything approaching a smoking gun, it's not going to be declassified. So what I believe happened on this document release is a lot of expectations and scholarship, quote-unquote, were focused on the big document release when we already kind of know what we need to know, that there was a cover-up, that the media was part of it, government and the courts were part of it, and it's an illusory use of our efforts to focus too much attention on our ability to kind of compel document release, particularly if we're looking for a smoking gun. On the other hand, if I can attempt an analogy to 9/11, that doesn't mean efforts for more transparency are pointless. It's just a question of emphasis, of limited resources, and because in JFK we have had 2,500 books or more. We've had 4 million pages of documents. We have a lot of witnesses, so we can figure out the main outlines of the jigsaw puzzle. These current release of documents are useful, but we need to rely on independent and trustworthy experts to point out important points. Now, for those interested in this, I have a lot of this information on the Justice Integrity Project site. Also, as editor of the Citizens Against Political Assassination site, if one goes there, I think the website is called kappa-us.org, we have a section of current news. I'm looking at it now, and there's a lot of really great commentaries on this process from genuine independent experts who more or less say in different ways the kind of things I've said now, if you're interested in that. Let's see what else I can add about this. I'm frankly very quite frustrated with the process, including some of the reactions from the so-called JFK community, quote unquote. And I thought your debate at the earlier part of this call was pretty civilized and thoughtful. I'm seeing a lot of more less thoughtful, less civilized debates on this matter in the JFK community, and I and some of my colleagues actually suspect or fear that some of it could be just agent provocateur stuff. You know, some people are just acts of so stupidly that either they've gone nuts or they are trying to cause dissension over nothing. But that's a little bit of speculation. I don't know whether they're nuts or provocateurs, but there's common sense would tell us, however, that if people are serious enough to cause mass murder and a cover-up of courts, media, and so forth, popping up with a few agent provocateurs is nothing. Particularly, and I'll maybe end on this provocative note myself, but Cheryl mentioned that I had gotten my JD in law from the University of Chicago, and one of my professors there that actually I worked fairly closely with was none other than Cass Sunstein, the country's leading anti-conspiracist, quote, liberal law professor. And he didn't show that there, but he's got this book that I've got right on my shelf here, Conspiracy Theories and Other Dangerous Ideas. And as most of you probably know, he went on to write an article, co-author an article, saying that the government faces a problem. Tens of millions of voters believe in conspiracy theories. And he proposed three alternatives to fight that. One, to forbid conspiracy theories. Two, to tax them. or three, which he recommended among those three alternatives, was for the government to secretly hire agents who could penetrate journalism and academic circles and disrupt the conspiracy theorists in their areas. And, of course, he went on to become the top federal regulator, in effect, of the Obama administration as head of Office of Management and Budget's regulatory efforts in the Obama White House, and his wife, major warmonger Samantha Power, as UN ambassador and various national security posts. So that's my overview, and I guess you have a nice Q&A format, and I'd be delighted to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Andrew. Great presentation. If anyone wants to answer, ask a question. Thank you, Ken. So it's star 6 to ask a question or to get on the list. So if you want to ask a question, please do that now.
While we're waiting for others, nobody's on the list yet, I'd like to ask Andrew, is there anything in particular, Andrew, that is believed to be in the National Archives that was not released, kind of a omission that one could point to, you know, argue censorship there? Well, I'm sorry, Andrew's probably gotten muted here.
Here's one that
there
I'll,
go,
that
you
I'll mention.
You start over, Andrew. You were muted.
Here's one document that I'll mention, a series of documents. There's a whole missing file of Lee Harvey Oswald. And one of the things that's important about Oswald is not only was he the accused assassin, but there's a great deal of substantial evidence that he was an undercover operative for the U.S. government for several agencies. And just two compelling parts of this is he worked on the U-2 spy program in Japan, and if he was such a big misfit, why is that? Another thing is he somehow learned to speak Russian fluently in the U.S. Marine, which points to some kind of language training and potential involvement in a false defector program. And finally, when he got back from the Soviet Union, he worked for 6 months during the Cuban Missile Crisis on classified air photos, which is kind of not in keeping in late 1962 for somebody who's a big security risk. And there's lots of other evidence like that. And for that to be missing is quite significant. There are...
Okay.
Russ Baker of Who, What, and Why has done some very good writing on what are some of the documents that we were looking for that are not there. And Rex Bradford, who runs the Mary Farrell Foundation, named after a citizen who just started collecting documents on this, and it's the main digital private archive of documents. Rex has estimated that only about 5% of the documents have been released that were expected to be released, and
wow.
he's one of the people who has called it a travesty. And
that's interesting information. Thanks very much for that. Next to ask your question, Paul Zaremka. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah. This is Paul Zaremka. I was just interviewed with James Douglas and Ray McGovern. Sorry. And Global Research on the JFK assassination. And I haven't really worked on the JFK assassination for quite a while now, precisely because I thought Douglas went so far forward that we can just basically, I mean, I'm asking you a question here. I thought we've gone so far forward with his book that we actually can turn our energies elsewhere. I'm not trying to criticize you for what you're putting your energies into, but that's, at least I'm exposing you to my take.
Well,
so I'm wondering how you would react to that. And like, what else do we need to know?
Right. I'm not sure how your muting system works and whether people can hear me, but I don't disagree. I think part of why I've been involved is there has been such a focus that, oh, the government this year, 2017, is going to release all these documents, and I wanted to be part of that, and I am part of the that process, but I'm among the things I've done on the Justice Integrity Project site is create a 48-part reader's guide to books and films and all of that stuff. So far, 48 parts. And the Douglas book, I've ranked, you know, it's somewhat subjectively, but I've ranked that as most researchers think it's the best book. And it came out in 2009. And it's a very powerful book. It's called JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. And so I agree largely, but there is this community. And one of the things that I personally have done, was this James Petras? I read your stuff. Is that who asked the question?
No, Paul Zaremka.
Oh, hi, Paul. One of the reasons I've stuck with it is, and I recommend it to others up to a point, is that unlike 9/11, unlike a lot of other things, most of the public doesn't believe the official story. And the surveys show that between like low 60s and sometimes up to almost 80% of the public doesn't believe the Warren Commission. So if one is a reformer or a crusader or at least an advocate for peace and justice and all these things, it seems to me politically it's logical to start solidifying the support of 70% of the population and provide that ready-made audience with the information they need and to fight the Philip Sheenans and Larry Sabatos, which I've done in some of the articles in my Reader's Guide, and go to the wider public and say, you're right, the fake news people are wrong, here's why. And then, conveniently, in my view, 2018 is the anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy. And as a longtime journalist, you know, I know that they often think in terms of 50-year cycles. So what I'm personally doing is gearing up to migrate this kind of knowledge and advocacy from JFK to RFK and Martin Luther King, because experts who I believe say that neither one of their accused assassins could possibly have killed the man, just like Oswald physically, from scientific medical evidence, could not possibly have killed JFK. And if you think about that progression, and you go early next year to the Martin Luther King community, which is not going to be easy, but you've got ready-made all kinds of people who are ready to remember Martin Luther King with special focus next year. And if you can, if you, we, I, all of us who believe this can say, well, just like JFK wasn't really killed by him, neither was Martin Luther King, bring forward, I've created a Martin Luther King Reader's Guide series, and it may be wishful thinking, probably is, but, you know, all over the country, there are black studies departments, there are people who care about Black Lives Matter, and there is a black life that did matter. And if he was murdered and the real person was never captured, that should be a big deal. And going to Robert Kennedy, if you can make a similar point next year, or we can, you're basically talking about the elimination of the top three charismatic progressive peace leaders in recent American history. And for people who care about any kind of politics, particularly left of center, that should be a big deal too. And finally, I'll just say that I find a lot of the people who care the most about this stuff are conservatives, and they start with an additional set of concerns about the Nixon resignation, the shooting of George Wallace, the Oklahoma City, and of course 9/11. And so there's a very clear path that I see, and I'd love to, I'm going to shut up about this now, but I'd love to know what people on the call think of that proposed progression.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And Wayne, you're next. Wayne Preston.
Yes, this is Wayne. So first of all, Andrew, I want to thank you for recognizing how well the conference call is run, because even though Craig and I, for example, have different opinions, the moderators managed to do a very good job of making sure everyone is heard. My question, excuse me, my question for you was going to be, during the day of the Boston bombing, I understood that the JFK Library in Boston had a fire, and I was wondering if there might be any insights or documents that might have been lost there that weren't released, or if you've heard anything about that. That's all I have for now. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Here's what I'd say. I'd say the Boston bombing should have been the last, or it's high on my list to investigate. I mean, I challenge people, not on this call but elsewhere, to say what the motive was for that. And I think I know, but it's a suppressed story. Yet I haven't got around, frankly, to looking at it in so much depth on the JFK fire, but I will take a slightly, I'll use that for a related point. Many of us in the JFK and RFK and assassination research community have a hope that I now regard as a vain hope, that the Kennedy family will stand up and lead the charge for transparency. And to the extent that those here might be interested in my own progression on that, I'll say it's much like the release of documents, a vain hope. I believe that there's a significant question whether not just John and Robert Kennedy were killed, but John Jr., who went to my high school, a lower school of my prep school, was intentionally killed too. And I also believe, and this is all, you know, kind of secondhand, or even third-hand information, but it fits the pattern, that that family was scared to death for good reason. And with a few exceptions, including Robert Kennedy's comments as he was running for president in and some of John Jr., they realize they, despite all the glamour, wealth, power, and all the legend, and that they are nothing compared to the deep state, the military-industrial complex, and that the current generations, like the surviving members of the previous ones, they're going to give awards for courage on lighter topics, but they're not going to get into the deep state or the assassination of their relatives. And that's the way it is, and it's really up to us, the independent research community, to make our points and make our research and not look for some young Kennedy to lead the way. They've seen the power of the deep state firsthand, and it's quite chilling.
Okay. Thank you. Gerald Pachechin, you're up. Go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Andrew, my name is Gerald Pachechin. Here I'm with the Executive Intelligence Review, and we were approached by the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, Ray McGovern, Bill Binney, mm-hmm. a number of months ago. People may be aware from Consortium News that they've done some forensic analysis and other types of analysis. And the reason I'm saying this, because to me, the 800-pound gorilla in the room right now, which intersects all the things that have been discussed tonight from 9/11, JFK, RFK, you know, the deep state, da-da-da-da, is this present insanity of Russia hacked the DNC and McGovern and Binney. And Binney, as you know, was in the NSA and through his program was definitely saying 9/11 could have been stopped. It was deliberately allowed to happen. And so my question to you, Andrew, is we had a very successful meeting at Symphony Space in New York a couple of Sundays ago on November 12th, and there was a really outstanding response of people to The Good American, the movie that Oliver Stone did on Binney's thing with Diane Rourke and others. So do you possibly see busting this whole thing open about Russia hacked the DNC as a wedge to take down the deep state? Because if you take down the apparatus, then you can free up things on all of these things, whether it's Kennedy assassination, et cetera, 9/11, et cetera. You take the apparatus down, boom, the door's opened up for the whole ball of wax. So that's my question, Andrew.
Well, first, I know and respect not only Ray McGovern and Bill Binney, but also your publication, my good friends. I've got several good friends, including Steinbergs, your organization,
mm-hmm.
and also Consortium News. So I've followed this. I'm not an expert on it, but since you asked the question, my best answer is I don't see exposing holes in the Russia story as likely to have the kind of effects that you articulated and that I might hope for. And here's why. First of all, the mass media has marginalized all the critics in a really despicable way. I look at these CNN, you know, anchor types, and you know, their lips curl as they describe my friend Bill Binney as a conspiracy theorist. and no matter what we do, you know, they're reaching tens of or millions of people, and we're doing our best to get the word out to thought leaders, but it's hard. And you know, he's a good man, and so is Ray, but you know, we just don't have the resources to fight that. The other thing that's substantive, and it clouds the message, is that while I'm not an expert in intelligence, I've got a lot of books that I read, and I talk to people, and I read a lot, but I'm not an expert on the level of Bill Binney and Ray McGovern, or even the journalists like you guys and Robert Perry at Consortium News, but it seems to me that all of these countries and intelligence agencies are constantly tampering with each other's countries. and so to, you know, I made some fairly flat statements that scientifically it doesn't look like Oswald could have killed Kennedy with the fatal bullet. But I would not want to bet everything I had that Russia doesn't do intelligence operations in the U.S. In fact, I would bet the opposite. And so it's a question of degree, and we don't quite know what they're doing. My friend Wayne Madsen, who's dug deep into this and who also respects all of the people I named, but Wayne and others are doing a great job of looking at how people who may not even be from Russia but might be of Russian origin, they might be living in Britain or Eastern Europe or anywhere, are all quite capable of working out deals with people, Trump supporters, and doing something somewhere. And so it's a cloudy picture, and I'm curious, again, I guess I'm supposed to answer questions, but I'm interested in what other people think of what I'm saying, because it's a two-way dialogue.
Can I add one note on what you just said?
Sure.
Make it very quick, because we got to move on.
Real quick. The note to add is, my understanding is that Binney was personally contacted by President Trump, and this was in the media. He did have a meeting with Pompeo, and my understanding is there's further interest in Binney's assessment of the, not only of Russiagate, but of the crap that still is hanging around, so that there is a possible wild card in that situation, namely Trump himself.
Well, I've heard that, and but Trump might be interested in that kind of meeting, whether or not there was actual Russian involvement. But at any rate, our moderator has spoken. So
okay, sure, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and lastly, Greg Longo. Thanks for your patience, Greg. Please make it brief. Go ahead. Greg Longo.
Hi, Greg.
Hello. Hi.
Great to talk to you.
I had a couple of questions. I just read recently that James Jesus Angleton, was, besides being head of the CIA, was a founding member of the Mossad. I wanted to know if you'd heard that. And also, I wanted to know if you heard of Michael Collins Piper's book, came out in 1994, called Final Judgment about JFK.
Yeah, okay, go ahead with your question.
And I also agree with your thinking that there's a continuity between all these things. Like RFK was killed in the Crown Hotel, or the Crown Family Hotel. And the Crown family was one of the top three fundraisers for Obama when he was first running for presidency. And also the Oklahoma City bombing. I just learned recently that this person, this unknown German named Strassmeyer, supposedly called a German, was married to an Israeli. So I'd like your comments on those three, if you can remember all three of them.
Well, I'll try. I've got the Michael Collins Piper book on my shelf. I haven't read it. I've occasionally dug into it, and you know, it's exhaustively researched, and you know, the pages I've looked at have new information that seems relevant and interesting and sourced. Part of the problem, though, is I'd mentioned earlier that there's 2,500 books, and there's not quite 2,500 theories, but there's a lot of different theories. And when you have smart people cherry-picking the information, they can make a pretty coherent story to identify a whole bunch of actors as the main people. And they can't all be the main people. I try to stay away from who actually planned it, because it's divisive, and get into how do we stop the cover-up that extends to the present. Regarding Angleton, there's a number of actually recent books, including one by Jefferson Morley, on Angleton. It can be important and interesting, that kind of detail, but it's again sometimes apocryphal, some of these most dramatic statements. Co-founder of the Mossad, when you think about it, how likely is it that a non-Jew is going to be a co-founder of the Mossad? Well, it's possible, but it's probably easier and more sustainable as analysis to say, as a fallback, he worked with the Mossad. And if some part of the problem in this kind of historical research is the best quotes, like JFK saying, "I'm going to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces," those are inherently a comment that would be made under the breath to an aide with no written record. And we can never be 100% sure that the comment was made. And by the way, one other thing, and I know we're running out of time, so I'll make it the last aside here, is that one of the things we see in document releases is not only that some documents are suppressed or redacted or made a big thing of by the commentators, but some documents are actually created to mislead future people. And so, you know, we can't find a document that was made in 1962 and totally believe that everything it says was true. So, for example, just to illustrate that, Dr. John Newman, who was at one point assistant to the director of the NSA, is now a historian who's kind of aligned with what we like to research. He's discovered 100 different identities for one of the main CIA people, David A. Phillips. And Dr. Newman says part of these identities were to fool his compatriots within the CIA who he worked with, to think that to keep them in the dark and compartmentalized. So I hope I've answered your questions and not gone on too long, Greg.
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Greg. And that's it, Cheryl. That was the last question.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, Andrew, for your presentation and for answering all those questions. And
oh, thank
for
you.
Being willing to join us, yeah.
No, great group. So maybe I'll sign off, but hope to see you all personally again. And
you're always welcome back, Andrew, anytime, okay?
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. With that said, then it's time to move on to announcements, and I know one person mentioned having one, but I'll tell you what, we'll just stay in Q&A session. If you have an announcement, just click *6, and you'll be back in the queue, and we'll take your announcement, okay? *6 if you have an announcement to share. And meanwhile, just reminding you that our next teleconference will be the last Wednesday in December, which just happens to be midway between Christmas and New Year's, so that works out really well this year. We don't have any scheduling conflicts. Okay, our first announcement is from Wayne Kosky. Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, this is Wayne. So I just wanted to follow up from a conversation we had last month, in which Craig had and others had pointed out the Google searches were problematic and that they were redirecting people away from what we'll call truth sites. We posted an article on the website 911tap.org that basically is along these lines, and I encourage people to take a look at that. And it's got some links to other articles that have addressed the same issue. It's one that we'd like to address in a future, maybe a December meeting in a little more detail. But the article is what we have at the moment. Thanks, and happy holidays.
Thank you, Wayne. Can you stay on the call, by the way, after everybody leaves? I need to talk with you for a second about the TAP website.
Sure. I'll stay online.
Thank you very much. Okay. Does anybody else have an announcement or question or comment? Just to be on the safe side here, I'm going to unmute everybody in case anybody's having trouble unmuting him or herself. Do you have an announcement to share that you would like to share? Anyone?
I think you muted everybody, Ken. You've actually muted everyone, not unmuted them.
Okay, let's try that again.
Chuck Smith would like to say something.
Okay. Who else would like to make an announcement?
Chuck Smith.
Chuck Smith, yeah. Go ahead, Chuck.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to come at that JFK thing just quickly at a different angle. I've got two videos on my YouTube channel, one from Gaddafi and another one from a fellow who is very close to Yasser Arafat. And both of them say that David Ben-Gurion gave the order to kill Kennedy. Now, so coming at it from that angle, if that's true, then one of David Ben-Gurion's best pals was Angleton. And Angleton was best friends with Kortmeyer and that Harvey guy, Bob Harvey, who all had it in for Kennedy and were very close to Edgar Hoover. So coming at it from that angle, the pieces just fall into place.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sort of ties in with the question that Greg had about Michael Collins Piper, who would, of course, been dovetailed with that analysis. Okay, so thanks for that. Anybody else have an announcement or a closing remark?
I would just like to ask, Chuck, where are those videos? They're on YouTube?
Oh, yeah, they're on my YouTube channel.
Okay.
Charles Ewing Smith.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Yeah, okay, so if you want to access those, you go to YouTube and you look for the Charles Ewing Smith channel, and you'll find them. Okay.
Yeah.
There's some other good stuff there too, I should mention. I'm a subscriber to Charles's channel, so I know.
There's almost 400 videos there.
Yeah. Yep. You'll find lots to keep you busy there. Okay, anything else anybody wants to share with the group before we leave? Well, hearing none, then we'll thank you all for your participation tonight and your good civic behavior, and we'll see you the last Wednesday in December. Have a good one. Merry Christmas.
Bye, thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Bye. Goodbye.
Wayne?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, good. Okay. Well, there's still a couple other people online, but I'm sure it'll drop. But anyway, the reason why I asked to talk to you is having to do with the TAP website. And apparently, from what I can understand, despite my request to Tim Michael, they are posting
under the comments on our on the announcement about this teleconference, the call-in number. It's the alternative call number, but it's still a working call-in number. And that really shouldn't be posted, okay?
Okay.
What should be posted instead is that if anybody is interested to just contact me with their with information about their affiliation with the 9/11 Truth Movement, and they can be added to the invitee list, and then they will be invited to participate. But that's our normal process, okay?
Right. I mean, I thought I had done it that way. Maybe it got updated. You know, Tim. Sometimes
here's what happens. Yeah, if you click on that event and you look under the comments, what he did is he just abstracted from our monthly thing, and it has all the information about the alternative call number. I don't know why the alternative call number, but that's what's there. It's posted openly. Okay.
All right. I'll go online and I'll take care of that. Okay.
Yeah, but also make sure that people know how they can become part of the Cattle Arms if they want to. Okay, so just to you know, drop us an email and let us know of their interest and their affiliation, and then we'll include them. Okay.
Yeah. Can you hang on just a minute? I've got my laptop open, and let's go.
Okay.
Got to log in. Yeah, I mean, I when I posted it, I didn't have that in there. But I think what he did is he put the may have pasted in something.
He did. He pasted. He clearly pasted a whole bunch of text on the bottom there, which includes the call-in number.
Right. Okay. So now let me go. We'll go edit, the main event. All right, so to join the conference call. How do you want this to be, please?
Contact Ken Freeland, or contact the facilitator. Maybe you say the facilitator.
The facilitator.
At diogenesquest@gmail.com.
All right, I'll paste in your email there.
Yeah, letting him know of your connection with the 9/11 Truth Movement and your interest in joining the teleconference. That's all, okay?
Letting him know of your affiliation.
Or your involvement, however you want to verse that.
9/11 Truth Community.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
that's good.
So letting him know of your affiliation with the 9/11 Truth Community and... What you said something else.
And your interest in joining the teleconference, that's all. And your interest in participating in the teleconference.
Yeah, to join the teleconference, please. The teleconference. The teleconference. Join the teleconference call, please contact the facilitator at blah blah blah, letting him know of your affiliation with the 9/11 Truth Community and interest in joining the teleconference. Right. Period.
That's it.
Okay, so period. I'll get your email address and then I'll paste it in there. And
okay.
I think it should be something else. Okay, great. I'll take care of that.
Thank you so much, Wayne. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ken. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Anybody else on the call?